Right. Good evening, afternoon, welcome. So first of all, I want to thank the shul, Chabad, for hosting this. We're very grateful. And I want to thank the Solovinskis, Avraham, and Vicky. She's coming today. Thank you for making this happen. Okay, so we are here today representing the Jewish History Keepers Foundation, which its goal is to make sure that Jewish history is kept and appreciated and understood. But I think that maybe tonight, rather than focusing on the history and on the keeping, maybe we'll try to understand what is it that we're actually keeping? What is Jewish? So we know Jewish, it means to be Jewish, but what is the Jew? What is the Jew about? Who are the Jews? So for that, we have to understand Judaism. What is Jewish? So Judaism can be divided into three categories, which is what we discussed. Basically, there is the Jewish view of God, there is the Jewish view of Jews, the people, and then there is the Jewish view of the Torah, which is the book which explains the relationship between God and the Jewish people and what it is that we are supposed to do. I mean, so those are the three categories. And we're going to start with the most complicated of the three, which is, what do Jews believe? Specifically, in terms of belief in God. And I think the way that the question was phrased originally when we were discussing how to discuss this, I think the question was, why do people still believe in God? And I think that's the reason why we're asking this question this way is because that's actually the way most people ask the question. People who ask me this question, they say, you know, after all the advances that the world has made in knowledge and science and all of these areas, why are you still believing these old religious ideas? Or as I heard once someone phrase it to me, why do you still believe that there's someone up there, some old man in the sky who's throwing lightning bolts at people? And of course, the famous answer that's always given to that is that the God that you don't believe in, I don't believe in that God either. Right? This image that people have of this old angry man who's punishing, it's not even the beginnings of what we believe. What we believe is that there is a God who created the world, who is not a creation. That's because, you know, it's a very interesting thing. You know, we always tell when a Jewish child comes home from school and says to his mother, "I learned today in school that God created me." But who created God? Right? Great question, right? So what does every Jewish mother do? Wow, what an amazing question. Just wait till your father gets home. He's going to be so proud of you. And then the father comes home and the mother says, "You won't believe the question that your son asked today." And the father says, "What is it?" And he says, "Well, you know, God created me. Who created God?" And the father goes, "Wow, that's brilliant. That's amazing. My son is so smart. I'm so proud of you. Let's take this question to the rabbi." And then they meet with the rabbi and they tell the rabbi. The rabbi is like, "Wow, you have such a smart child." Why? Because in Judaism, we like questions. We like questions. Challenge. Go ahead, challenge. Because if it can't stand up to challenges, then why are you believing it, right? So we like those kinds of questions. And then the rabbi sits down with the child and explains to him, you have to understand, God is not a creation. If God were a creation, it wouldn't be God. Right? You see, the way we believe, there's existence. See, the problem is that most people start with, well, how did the world come to be? Well, the earth is a rock that bounced off this and then came to that, and then magically all these green things grew, and then there was a soup, and from the soup came tadpoles, from the tadpoles came dinosaurs, from the dinosaurs came people, right? Whatever story you have, right? And then if you ask, well, what caused it? Well, there was a Big Bang. What was before? Universally, the answer will be, it's not my department. Ask any experts, not my department. I don't know, how am I supposed to know? Right? But you see, we're not, when we're studying metaphysics, you know, when we're talking about Judaism, we're not talking about how the earth came to be. We're talking about how existence came to be. And we believe that there's a God beyond existence who created the world. Why did he create the world? Why would God need to create the world? That's a complicated question. I could spend the rest of the lecture just talking about that. But let me give it to you in the simplest terms possible. Because God is good. Because God is perfect. Because God is beyond existence. And so if God is good and perfect and beyond existence, then to be good, you have to be benevolent. There needs to be someone to receive that good. And so God said, let there be. Now, at what point in time did God make this choice? It's a silly question because God doesn't have time. Right? Time begins when God says, let there be time. Words exist. Ideas exist. When God says, let there be words, let there be ideas. Before that, we can't comprehend. You know, it's not like trying to explain it to a little child. Trying to understand what God is like trying to explain what this is to a cat. That's why when other religions came along and offered their opinions as to what Jews should believe, Jews rejected them. They became angry, of course. We'll get to anti-Semitism soon. But the reason why we reject is because any time you're talking about a God that's anything less than everything beyond everything, that's not God anymore. Right? At least that's what we believe. And so, and the reason why I believe in God is because otherwise I wouldn't believe anything existed, because what caused existence to exist? And the answer to that is going to be the answer to everything. Now, I know that's really complicated. That's probably the hardest part of the lecture. The rest will be a little bit lighter in terms of... because, you know what? When you're talking about God, if you're going to try to simplify God, which is what many people have tried to do because they want people to believe in God, so here, let me package God for you. It doesn't quite work that way. Because as one famous philosopher once said, if I could encapsulate God in my mind, I would be God. I know it's a complicated idea. But that's... So how can someone in today's world still believe in God? I hear the question phrased differently sometimes. You know, Darwin figured out that actually all the animals, they come one from another, which shows that it actually happens on its own, and therefore that proves that there's no God. And so this question has been brought before me many times. You know what the answer to that is? One second, let me get this straight. You're telling me you found a perfect pattern in creation, and you're using that as proof that there isn't intelligent design? Let me ask that question again. You found that creation is a perfect pattern. You see all the animals lined up. Everything is perfect. The ecosystem, everything's... And you figured it all out. And the more you figure it out, the more you realize that it's incredibly brilliant, beyond anything that we can fathom. You know gravity? Gravity. Something as simple as gravity. As simple as gravity. Stephen Hawking, I'm sure you all know who he is, in his A Brief History of Time, says... You know, there's six things which we scientists say we don't understand. Electromagnetism, gravity, he has a list of those things. They just are. And sometimes I read this and I say, you know, he's a very religious man. Right? And it almost seems like the whole scientific community, it's just a different religion. It's just a religion that involves believing in things that you've decided you believe in without necessarily receiving information from on high. So back to the original question. Again, I know this was complicated, but how can someone in the modern world believe in God? I say the more that we've learned in the world that we live in today, the more I see the hand of God. The more I realize that God is signing his name everywhere. When I see the complexities of what's beyond, I mean, honestly, let's be honest with ourselves. Do we really believe that some rock bounced off another rock and the resulting chain effects of one after the other is human beings who can recognize themselves? Self-awareness? I mean, think about it. Self-awareness. Just my knowledge that I exist. That came from rocks bouncing off of each other? Right? If there isn't someone who's organizing it, who isn't, and so you'll say, well, the part of the issue is, and I think that's right, is that because the way that the world describes religion is in a very simplistic way, I think people who are more complicated, and we should be more complicated, have a hard time saying that doesn't make sense. But if what you believe, if you understand it more deeply, I think at that point it becomes even more illuminating. And so, again, why do people still believe in God? My question is, how can anyone not? How can you believe that all of this is a result of a bunch of random accidents? I mean, okay, explain that to me. Maybe someone can. However, the concept of believing in God has changed throughout the generations. What we believe, according to what's described in the Torah tells us that in the beginning God created the world and he had a relationship with Adam and Eve. That's, you know, we could give a whole lecture separately on that. Everything's its own lecture, right? But then God basically revealed himself to the prophets, first to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and while the rest of the world believed in pagan gods, they believed in sticks and stones, and basically what they worshipped was the elements of the forces of nature. So there were people who worshipped the sun, there's people who worshipped the moon, people who worshipped both, people who worshipped the stars, different constellations. People worshipped all kinds of things because they all understood that there's some greater power. But the problem is, believing in something that I can't put my fingers on is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable, especially if I have no guidance. What am I supposed to do? How do I worship God? But yet I know I'm supposed to do, I know there's good and evil. Everyone knows there's good and evil. We're born understanding the difference between, in some ways, between good and evil. But what exactly is the proper lines of what defines what's right and what's wrong? People have a hard time figuring that out. So if I we had these priests who, you know, said, do this, do that, and but you see where the world went, right? The pagans, they were practicing human sacrifice and things worse than that. Until God came to the prophets and revealed himself and gave the Torah. You know, I hear a lot of people say, we'll actually get to that later. You know, we can just live a moral life today just by doing what we know to be good. I think everyone has a basic understanding of what's good and what's bad. But let me ask you, how do you have this basic understanding? How do you know what good and bad is? Because you grew up in a society that taught you good and bad. Where did the society learn what's good and bad? Because there were people thousands of years ago, the Aztecs. Yeah, Aztecs are beautiful people that make great tortillas. How long? 500-600 years ago? And they were still practicing human sacrifice when the Spanish people came here. In fact, the reason why they were so quickly destroyed was because all the towns around were helping the Spanish to defeat the Aztecs, because the Aztecs weren't sacrificing their own people, they were taking from the neighbors, which is how it was done in old times. So how do we live in a society? So you've heard, these are Judeo-Christian values, right? So it's interesting how the Christians kind of put themselves in there. This goes back to the Torah, which we'll get to later. The Torah teaches us some of these basic ideas. It taught humanity the difference between right and wrong. Many of the things which we understand today to be given, humanity didn't figure it out on its own. They just didn't. It is we, the Jewish people, who are commanded, as it says in the book of Isaiah, to be or goyim, to be a light unto the nations, and we're meant to teach the world, not because we're smarter than anyone else, but because we received the Torah. And so what we believe, therefore, is that there is a God, there must be a God, there is obviously a God. And the world sometimes has a hard time catching on, and it's because most people would like to live a life based on what feels good in the moment. And living a life that's sort of higher value is a difficult undertaking. And so that's why most people won't even hear this conversation being said out loud. And that's an interesting thing to me, because if someone comes to me and says to me, I just want you to hear what I believe, I'd listen. I have. It doesn't sound very convincing to me what other people believe, because, you know, I've got a system for how I understand things, but I appreciate that there are other people who understand things differently. But what happened is that as Judaism expanded, the world began to move away from paganism. But interestingly, it wasn't the Jews who brought the world away from paganism. It was actually Aristotle. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, but mostly Aristotle, who taught the world that the belief in these... In other words, what he introduced to the world was, let's stop getting into all this superstitious stuff, and let's just think rationally. Let's all think rationally. And Aristotle, you know what his rational conclusion came to? That there is a God. Except that Aristotle believed that, you see, if God is really that great, why would he care about me? So that's why Aristotle believed that there's a God, and because there's a God, there's a world, but one has nothing to do with the other. And the reason why Aristotle believed it was because he had such an incredibly deep understanding of God that he said God is so high that it's almost, this is what he said, it's almost beneath God to even know of my existence, to even know that I exist. Of course, the problem with Aristotle is that he's limiting God. He thinks that God has these human emotions where it's, you know, too boring to think about people. So Aristotle, you know, at least got halfway there. But then Aristotle's wisdom started to spread through the world. Greek wisdom spread through the world. But it didn't win. It didn't win the battle against paganism, because at the same time, within a few hundred years, came along Christianity and filled the world with the Christian view of the world, which is sort of semi-monotheistic. Let's not get into Christianity right now. It's a basically monotheistic, at least within some level of it. And so the world went, one second, you mean these sticks and stones are not God, but God is something greater? Sounds good to me. And so the world, and then Islam expanded into the world. And this lasted until the 1700s, when the Enlightenment came along. And, you know, starting, let's blame it on Voltaire. Why not? He deserves the blame. So Voltaire and all the people who came along with that, they told the world, no, you see, and actually what they're really doing is moving away from religion into Epicurism. Epicurists, who really said that, you know, we don't know anything. And so the Enlightenment, which is supposed to bring light to the world, is really just a way of saying, well, we don't know anything to be true, so let's not believe in anything. And that's why you find yourselves in a world today where everyone says, no, you don't know anything to be true, and since we don't know anything to be true, therefore, believe what you want. It's a really interesting way. I mean, that's, I'd say, really risky, because what if you're wrong, right? But yeah, that kind of, I don't know, and therefore I'm just going to live my life, it's really comfortable, but, I mean, the disappointment when you get up there, and it's like, really, there is something? Could you send me back down? I want to redo this, which... Anyway, the story of the human belief in God, the whole of whether we do or don't believe in God, it's complicated because human beings are complicated. And we're not here to mock anyone for their beliefs. People have to, but we have to be able to hear, to think. That way of, that so many people live in, which is that they just close their minds because they don't want to hear. That's probably the most dangerous thing in the whole world. And whatever it is that you believe, it should be because you've thought about it. And to me, yeah, I grew up in a religious society, but that doesn't mean that I just accepted whatever I was told. There are books, and these books ask all the questions. All those questions that you're always under the impression that if you're religious, you're not allowed to ask. There are some other religions that believe that. In Judaism, Maimonides, the greatest Jewish philosopher of the last 1,000 years, wrote a book called The Guide to the Perplexed that some religious Jews are afraid to read because the questions that he asks are so compelling that if you don't understand the answer, you're going to be left with the question. The one famous rabbi used to read all the answers and then read the questions. Yeah, just to make sure he got the answer before he read the question. But this is, in Judaism, we believe that you're supposed to use your mind. God gave you your mind, not for you to shut it down and believe, but use your mind and find God. Because even though we cannot fathom God, we can't fathom, but we do believe that if God created us, that clearly there was a reason. Let's just stop right there, right? If God created us, it was for a reason. And if God intended for there to be a reason, but for us to guess it, we would be doing a really bad job. Human beings can't figure anything out. I mean, let's take something simple. Take an idea like this. There are countries in the Far East where your honor is worth more than your life. If you disgrace yourself, you're better off taking your life. Right? Is that true in the United States of America? There'd be very few people left in this country, right? So are they wrong? How would I know, right? So human beings can't figure anything out. We can't even figure out something as simple as which is more valuable, your honor or your life. Right? Let's take the following. It's a very simple question. Is there a crime that someone can commit for which they deserve to be killed? Capital punishment, right? Very simple question. I'm not getting into the actual discussion. I'm just pointing out that there are people today who believe that the most morally good thing in the world is to put to death people who commit a certain level of crime. And there are other people who say murderers. You're murderers. Why are you killing a person because he killed? What are you gaining by adding another death? So who's right? How do we resolve a question like that? So God put us in this world and had us figure out and guess whether something is murder or kindness. Doesn't make sense, right? If God created the world, there must be some way that we should be able to figure this out. So we believe that God told us. He gave us a book called the Torah. And in the Torah, God lays out, here are the ideas for what's right and what's wrong. We'll get to that in just a bit, but I want to come back to, we believe that the original plan was, this is what our sages teach us, and so this is what I believe, that the original plan was for there to be God and humanity. It was not supposed to be the Jewish people. It was just God created Adam and Eve, and their offspring, their children, humanity, would be those who have this relationship with God, who are devoted to God, and in return receive whatever the great goodness is. I don't think we even put on the lecture the concept of heaven and hell, which is, again, a lecture, two lectures on their own. But originally the plan was for all of humanity, but humanity rejected God, meaning that there is one thing that God is not in charge of, because it would miss the point, and that's your free will. We believe that there's free will granted. Every person, you are able to live your life however you choose. Now, God affects things that happen in the world, but you can live your life however you choose to live it. There's choices that are good for you and choices that aren't so good for you, but it's all given to you, and that's the concept of free will. One of the questions that we said we were going to discuss, you know, if there is a God, then why do bad things happen? Why is there evil in the world? Or, I've heard this question so many times that I'm going to throw it out there even though no one here has asked it. You know, where was God by the Holocaust? Right? How could there be a Holocaust if there's a God? God, you know, he's supposed to be watching the Jewish people. There are a number of answers to this question. We can't go through them all. But the most important answer is that there's free will. In order for God to create the world in a way where we can receive this good, whatever that good is, however we understand it, which again we can't discuss today. In order for us to receive this good, this world that we are here in is not the end. Because I'll tell you this, any God that creates humanity just for us to live this life seems like he could have done better, right? Let's be honest. Anyone here not have, let's use the Jewish word, tsaros, troubles? Anyone here not free, perfect life, everything's always been exactly the way you wanted it? Well, where's the good God? Where's this benevolent God who's giving me all the goodness? The answer is this life is where you work and toil and you try to do your best to be a good person and to do the right thing. And we believe that ultimately there is the good, which is so good that we can't even... it's going to take me a long time, but I'm going to say it anyway. Incredible parable. There was once a child came to a candy shop. His parents gave him his allowance, $1 for the week. He walks into the candy shop, and you know those old candy shops where they have all these drawers. You open them up, you have the scooper. So he goes over to his favorite candy, opens up the drawer, he's about to take a candy, and the candy man says to him, "Oh, you don't want that." He says, "No, this is my favorite candy." He's like, "Trust me. Two up, three across. That's the one that you want." So listen, I know this is my favorite candy, but the candy man says, so I take it, gives the candy man $1, goes outside, puts the candy in his mouth. It's the best candy he's ever had. He's like, it's amazing. The candy man really knows his stuff. So he comes back the next week with his dollar, excited to buy his new favorite candy. And when he walks into the shop, the candy man says to him, no, you don't want that. He says, really? Yeah, it was really good. He's like, no, two down, six across, that's the one you want. So, listen, he got it right last time. Gives him the dollar, takes the candy, walks outside, eats the best candy he's ever had. Third week he comes in, he's not even, which one now? And so each week, this one, that one, takes him through the store. A few months later, he comes into the shop. And the candy man says to him, so which one are you going to get? So he says, well, you tell me. He says, oh no, you've had all the candies, you've tried them all, now you just take what you want. So he said, what do you mean? It's over? That's it? There's nothing better than this? I was so excited. I was waiting for something better. Not really. There isn't really anything better. So just, says, really? I was really, Candyman says to him, listen, I want you to know, there is one candy which is so good. I'm using candy as an example, but it's so good. The only problem is, you're going to have to take 6 months off of eating candies before you can eat this. What do you think the kid does? Now, would he trust anyone else to take 6 months off his favorite candy? No, but this is the candy man. And the candy man has proven himself to know what he's talking about. And so he takes 6 months off. Of course he takes 6 months off. Okay? God created this world and filled it with so much good, just so that you can know that he knows what good is. And I think that's part of the problem. We picture heaven as, you know, these people with wings and harps. That's the far side, right? Heaven is people with harps, and hell is people with accordions. Heaven is God's goodness. And he says, listen, I know what you like. You know why I know you like? Because everything in this world that you like, it's because God not only made those things, but gave you the ability to recognize them and to feel them and to experience them. Because you should know that I've never tasted dog food. But I know there's such a thing as gourmet dog food. I don't know what that means, but I guarantee you that your dog doesn't know what that means. Right? So I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. You want to feel fancier, do whatever you want. There's people who do gourmet things that are less useful than dog food. And to each their own. Again, people should live their lives the way you want it. That's part of it. Live your life the way you want. Yeah, Judaism doesn't tell anyone what kind of food you can feed your dogs. You want a fancy dog with, you know, people put shoes on their dogs. Is the dog happy with shoes? I don't know. But God made all of these things, all the goodness, and he says, listen, here's what I want you to do. And if you do that, to be a good person and to live a good life, whatever you think is good here, it's much better there. So do I need to know what's there? I'd like to. I'd really like to. I would love for somebody to just open a window, just peek, ooh, that looks good, and then close it back up and be like, but you know what? I trust him. I trust him because God made the banana. And that's really good. And strawberries, and make up the rest of your own examples. So why is there evil and suffering? Again, because this is a world that's filled with challenges and difficulties, and bad people make bad decisions, and they do bad things. Where was God during the Holocaust? Not interfering with people's free will. Well, hey, what about when people get that bad? Well, if God's going to draw the line as to where he's going to interfere with free will, then there goes free will. Now, not everything that happens that's bad in this world is a result of free will. Children becoming ill, it's not someone's choice. And if you ask me, I don't know the answer. I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you why any specific situation. You know, people come like, well, why would this happen to my friend? I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that I know I've read and I've seen many answers in general as to why bad things happen. Bad things happen to challenge us. Bad things happen to bring out the best in us. And that's so true, because none of us would be as good as we are if bad things would not have happened to us. Now, bad things also make us angry, and that's why they challenge us. And sometimes bad things, like it or not, is a punishment too. And those punishments are good for us, because there seems to be an account, and we want a clean slate. But, you know, bad things happening is an important part of life. And that doesn't mean we can easily just, you know, ignore it and set it aside and just handle it. Things are hard, but they're hard for a reason. And everything is going to make sense when someone will explain it to us, which is what we're told. That after we leave this world, you know, a lot of people have this understanding that when you leave this world, your life will be shown before you. You'll see a video of your life. They'll replay it, and they'll analyze each of your actions. The truth is that once your soul is out of your body, your soul understands everything. The truth is that if you could currently in this moment recollect everything that's ever happened to you in your life, your whole life would make sense. Yeah, I hear like, well, why do bad things happen to good people? What makes you think they're good people, right? When you say good people, right? Everyone's a good person. And there are some people who need a kick in the pants, but everyone's a good person. People who I meet, they're all good. But you know, we've all done things that we're not very proud of. And you know what? I'm happy. I don't like it, but I'm happy that the things that I've done that need to be fixed are hopefully being fixed in this lifetime. And so why is there evil and suffering in the world? Because that's part of the world that God created, and that's part of the life that we need to live in order for us to accomplish what we need to accomplish in this lifetime. And if life was easy and everything went well, what would be the point? I'm not saying that we have to suffer in order for things to be exciting. But there does need to be a world of suffering for all of this to have meaning, for all of it to have some purpose. There has to be a process that involves good and evil, and each of us has to have the challenge to overcome this good and evil. And some people are really good at it and they become really good people, and there's some people who are really bad at it and they become really bad people. And you know what? What's even scarier than that is that those bad people think that they're very good people. You should know that every one of those SS guards believed that they were doing the world a goodness. And that's part of what we were saying before. Do you really think that we as human beings can figure it out on our own? This is how long ago was this? Thousands of years ago, the Holocaust? Millions of years ago? Right? Last century, there were people who believed that the extermination of a race was a goodness for the extermination of the Jewish people. Like, honestly, what have we done? Oh, come on, nobody really believes we control the weather. Because honestly, if I could, I'd be on that dial all day. Turn it to 75 and sunny every day. Right? That's it. But people have these kinds of crazy beliefs because some people, if you don't seek for a higher kind of guidance, and instead you use, well, this is what makes sense to me, which is, I think, the way most people think life should be. You ask most people, say, well, you could just live a good life based on what you understand to be good. Good luck. Good luck figuring any of that out. So, back to where I was saying before. So, the original plan was for humanity. But humanity refused. God had to bring the flood, and you know, we're not going to go through all the stories of the Bible. But eventually, there was Abraham. Avraham Avinu. our patriarch, who insisted that there was a God. He said, there is no way, he's made the same argument we just made, there is no way that there is a world here, and it's not here because someone arranged it, or something arranged it. And so he believed that, and God spoke to him, and it's hard for us to imagine the concept of God speaking to someone, but I believe that. I believe that God speaks to a human because God is capable of anything, just because I haven't experienced it myself. But I believe that God spoke to 600,000 souls, which is the collective 3 million people, all of us. All of us stood at Sinai. And I, as I was discussing with Avram earlier, I think all of us can even feel, on some level, deep inside of us, that we stood at Sinai and experienced the revelation from God. Because otherwise, what is that inside of you that is telling you that you want to do good? Why? Bad is so much more fun. Honestly. Could you imagine living with no morals? So why do you have morals? It's because something is telling you that there is a need for you to be good. What is that? That is your soul. That is the depth inside of you of something that's compelling you to be a better you. That's your soul. Soul isn't some... That's you. Animals don't have that. Animals can be very nice and very good, but they're following some pre-programmed instinct that's inside of them. And even though animals can have a personality, but not a soul on that level, animals have what's called a life source, which is a kind of soul, getting beyond ourselves. But the human soul, which is to be able to say, what is all this? Which begins with the ability to speak. How incredible that concept of speaking. Animals make sounds, but we're talking here about speech. It's a miracle. I have ideas in my head. I'm standing right here with ideas in my head, and I'm trying to put them into your head. How? By making these vibrations through the air that bounce onto these sensors in your ear, and then your ear takes those vibrations and says, here's what I think he's saying. And then it goes to your brain. Now you've heard. And then this other part of your brain says, well, what does that mean? One second, do I agree with this? Do I not agree with that? What is that? By accident, yeah. That happened by a bunch of rocks bouncing against each other off some big bang, and then all of a sudden people are... Yeah. Okay? So, Abraham speaks with God, and God makes a covenant with him and says, you and your children and whoever else would like to join. You know, Judaism is a really interesting religion because we believe that you can go to heaven even if you're not Jewish. It's really interesting because none of the other religions have this. But we believe that if you are a good Christian or a good Muslim or a good anything, a nice American, I'd say a law-abiding citizen of the United States of America, you're going to heaven. Right? As long as the seven Noahide laws. I mean, the Rambam, the language of Maimonides, is Chasidei ha'umos ha'olam yesh lahem chelek la'olam haba, which translates as good people of every nation go to heaven. But there's something special about being Jewish and keeping the Torah and being close to God. It's not just about heaven. And yeah, I mean, there's a special heaven and whatever, but you know, we're not doing it for the sake of reward in that sense. We know that the goodness is coming. But what we're doing is because we want to be part of this connection to God, because God made us. And what greater good can we do than to connect to our source, to the source of everything, to the meaning behind everything? God, and so the Jewish people carried this. And all the other religions, especially the monotheistic ones, emerged from Judaism, where basically they said, well, you know, we believe kind of like that, but a little different, or kind of like that, but a little different. But this led, once there was this understanding that there's the Jewish people, and then there's the rest of the world. The rest of the world did not react to that well, and they continue to not react to it well. Which is that they have a hard time hearing the Jewish people being referred to as the chosen people. Now, why? Because why should you be chosen? Now, the truth is, I didn't deserve to be chosen. God made a covenant with Abraham and said, all of your children, because what is a Jew? A Jew is one of two things. Either you're born Jewish, or you choose to become Jewish. Now, we understand if someone chooses to become Jewish, that they're Jewish, they're welcome. Everyone's welcome. But born Jewish, why should you be entitled to this great thing just because you're born into something? And the answer is very simple, because God made a deal with Abraham. He said, you amongst the rest of the world, the rest of the world walked away from God, and Abraham, and God said to him, here's what we'll do. The only thing is, 8 days old, you have to give a circumcision, sometimes a little later in life, but you know, that's back to your joke. But but this was a deal that was made, and so I was born a Jew. I was born a Jew, and I'm Jewish no matter what I do. There's nothing that I can do to make myself not Jewish, no matter what I do. But that doesn't mean that I'm necessarily automatically living a good life just because I was born a Jew. Right? So this leads to a struggle between those who are not Jewish, who, it's pretty very simply, resent the concept. Furthermore, the Jews seem to be an exceptional people. We say this, I'm sure you all do a Pesach Seder, and in the Seder, in the Haggadah, we all say, Melamed Shehoyu b'nei Yisrael Metsuyanim Sham, that the Jews were in Egypt, we were slaves in Egypt, and we were still, like everyone could feel there's something special about the Jew. And there is something special about the Jew. You know, there was a lawyer in the 19th century in the United States of America who sent a letter to a man called Samuel Clemens. You've heard of him? Mark Twain? He says, the Jews are these incredible people, but I hate them, and I don't know why. Could you explain to me why I do? So he wrote this book on the Jews. Everyone always quotes that last section where he talks about how amazing the Jewish survival is. But it's a whole book about Jews, and Mark Twain ends up concluding with, I don't really know, but here's my theory. He says, and this is Mark Twain, he says, the count gives everyone a parcel of land so that they can run their land and do what they do. The Jew plants his land, he does his thing, everyone works their land. Then one guy doesn't work his land. And he leaves it fallow, and at the end of the year, he's got to pay his taxes, and he doesn't know what to do. So he comes to the Jew and says, could you help me out? So the Jew says, fine, I'll run your land next year. Here's the payment for your work, and you give that to the taxes and this. And so, you know, 10 years later, this is Mark Twain, not me, 10 years later, the Jew owns the whole area, and everyone's angry with him. Why? Because he saw the system, and he worked with it. He wasn't lazy, and he worked hard. This is Mark Twain. Now, is that the reason why there's anti-Semitism? Because the Jews follow the system and therefore succeed? I don't think that's the reason. I don't think Mark Twain even believes that that's the reason. Right? But you know, I need to find a reason because it's so mysterious, almost mystical. The passion that others have, maybe passion's not the right word, have towards Jews. And that even, I mean, the answer is, because it's spiritual. The Talmud says something incredible. On which mountain was the Torah given? Sinai. What does the word Sinai mean? So says the Talmud, the Hebrew word sin'ah, which means hatred. It's the mountain at which point anti-Semitism descended into the world. Because you know when someone has a connection that you don't have, you resent that person for it. And if it's a deep spiritual connection, you don't even know why, but you just feel it. And maybe some of you are thinking, like, that doesn't make sense. We're rational people. Anti-Semitism is irrational. Think about it. It's irrational. How could there be that the most developed society in Europe. I mean, we're talking advanced, beyond advanced, in terms of morality. Germany was leading the world. And yet, the barbaric behavior, at mass scale, to the point of their own destruction, it's irrational. And it cannot be explained in any rational way. I mean, in specific situations, you know, Chmelnytsky said that the reason why he hated Jews so much was because some Jew once cheated him out of business. So because of that, he went through his uprising and killed 200,000 Jews minimum. That's the smallest number we have in Poland, which was at that time, you know, 1648, the Chmelnytsky uprising. Right? So the fact that there's a statue of him in all these cities, when are those statues coming down? I don't know. Okay. But meanwhile, the Jew has tried to do whatever we can do to make the world a better place. That's really the honest truth. I'm not here trying to undo the world. I don't know who these elders of Zion are, but I've never met them. And I've met all the big rabbis in the world, and none of them are part of this group. It's so silly, but yet people believe this kind of stuff because they need to believe it. They need to believe it because otherwise how else would they explain what it is they're feeling? And if what they're feeling is really, the truth is that anyone hates someone, how could a human being hate another human being? I don't understand it. I don't understand how you can hate. I understand you don't dislike it. This guy, some guy clicks his pen all day. You're annoying me. But to hate? Where does hate come from? And the answer is, you'll see this universally. People who hate is because they're missing something. Always, they're missing something, and they cope with missing something by hating on someone. And that's where anti-Semitism comes from. It comes from people feeling, I hate to say it, but spiritual FOMO is probably the closest term we have. Fear of missing out. The Jews have, generally speaking, had a lot of success despite the anti-Semitism, despite the hatred. And a lot of people think about, the Jews suffering in exile is, where is God? Name one nation in the history of the world that has gone into exile and survived 100 years as a distinct nation. Name one. 100 years. We have been in exile out of our country. A state was reestablished in 1948, but the majority of Jews still live in exile. But even until then, you're talking almost 2,000 years. How does a nation remain alive and distinct and exceptional? Look at the list of Nobel Prizes. We're not saying this to show off. We're saying here we are, 30%, right? 30% of Nobel Prizes for a nation that is 0.03% of 1%, right? 0.03%. Now, I once saw a theory on this. It's an old book written in the 20s called The Jewish Mystique. Don't ask me why I read it. I was somewhere and that was the only book available. But it's a great idea. He presents this interesting theory. He wants to suggest that the reason why the Jews are so exceptionally smart is because, he says, in the Jewish world, the smartest people, they were made to be rabbis. I don't know if that's still true today, but at least there was. And so the rabbis would marry the daughters of other rabbis, and so you'd have smart people marrying. Then they would have 15 children. And so there you had, basically, we were breeding geniuses. And meanwhile, in the Christian world, if you were smart and you became a priest, you took yourself out of the gene pool. Right? So that's an interesting theory. And maybe that works for the Christian world, but it's not true of the rest of the world. And so it's supernatural. It's supernatural because we are the people who were given the Torah. And the Torah is our guide for life. And even if you've never studied a word of Torah, it's so deep in your bones from hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. But we're talking hundreds of generations where your bones are filled with not just moral ideas, but just sheer brilliance. Because if you've read any of the Talmud, and I've had an opportunity to go through the Talmud, it's there aren't words to describe it. There's no book in the world like it, except for the other works. But the Jewish people are a special people, and we've done a lot of good for the world, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make this world a better place. And take a look at all Jews, even those who are unaffiliated. They're all so benevolent. Have you noticed that Jews are so giving? Jews are always so giving. And sometimes they give to what I consider to be the wrong cause, but what do I know, right? They consider it to be the right cause, but You know, sometimes when I say this, I feel like, well, why are you talking about the Jews? Other people also give. Okay, let them give lectures about what they do. I'm talking about what we do, right? And Jews are generous. We're giving. We're kind. We're nice. I don't know who these people are who are they talk about who want to destroy the world. Again, I've never met them. They don't exist, but except in people's imaginations. But that's what people need, because if you want to hate, you have to create something in order to fill that void inside of you, and that's your problem, not mine, right? That's... So then what is right? What is right? So we believe that God came to us and said, here's the book. Here's the book. It's called the Torah. The Torah has in it a guide to life, 613 commandments, tells you the difference between right and wrong. And it's interesting because I have the same moral beliefs as the patriarch Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov and Moshe. I believe the same things that they believe. 3,000 years, 3,500 years. The world has undergone changes. Every generation is new. Today's modern generation believes that everything you believed 20 years ago is all false. And they think that this is it. They finally figured it out. And they should know that their children will say that they're fools. And they'll create a revolution and rebel. And then their generation will rebel, their children will rebel against them. The world is constantly changing, evolving, changing its mind. This is okay, that's okay. We identify this way, we identify that way. Not discussing anyone's beliefs, just the fact that it's changing because each generation is just rejecting what was there before and trying something new. And it's interesting because they're actually recycling old ideas. It's like fashion, right? There's only a limited number of things. So the length of the skirt can only go, you know, from here to there, and the cut and the this, and you have this kind of sleeve and that kind of sleeve, but there's a limited amount. You know, what do they call the bell bottoms, right? Those will come back. They'll come back. They'll all come back because, you know, but each one thinks this is it.
They are back.
They are back. Thank you. Thank you. Right, exactly. Right, but each one thinks, and you look at people. I can't believe you wore those glasses back in the 70s. They're fashionable again, right? Those plastic whatever glasses, right? So what we believed has not changed for 3,500 years. And I think I'm a moral person in this world. I mean, I don't do everything right, but at least I understand morally the difference between right and wrong. But I'm believing something that was written 3,500 years ago. And how is that possible? It's never changed. It hasn't changed. It's the same Torah. And not only that, but all the stuff that's leaked out became the stuff that you now say, whoa, well, I have my own morals. Yeah, where'd you get those morals from? From the same 3,500 years of tradition which we are passing along. How can the Torah speak to a modern world? The Torah speaks to every generation. The Torah is universal because God did not write these rules. Now, if you'll ask me, well, why is, I don't know, not eating pork, why is that relevant to today's society? We don't have time to go through the 613 commandments, but there are books that explain every single one of those 613 commandments, what their purpose is, not only why they have such a rule, but what you're supposed to do with it and how it makes you a better person. Because, once again, it's the same morals. And so we have these books. They're available. Any bookstore. And they describe to you a system for how to live life, not based on some human being as wise as Aristotle or Einstein or Newton. Well, Einstein and Newton weren't so much moralists, but Aristotle certainly was. You know, you go forward in time. Let's go all the way to Nietzsche, right? What does he believe? We don't know anything. We don't know anything. So therefore, do what you want. Those are people who are trying to find what's morally correct. There are people out there who are trying to figure it out. And good for them. Everyone should try to figure out what the difference between right and wrong. You know, not everything your parents teach you about right and wrong. And you know, you grow up in a society. You grow up in one society, they teach you this is right and that's wrong. You grow up in a different society, right? What's correct? What's more morally correct? Communism or capitalism? Let's spend the next million years arguing over this. We won't come to a conclusion. But we'll understand that there are two sides. So how do we make a decision? The answer is, God said, you don't have to sit there. I'll tell you. Now, does that mean that there's no leeway? Oh, there is plenty of leeway within the Torah. Some people interpret it this way, some people interpret it that way, but all within that space where some people will say, well, this is the proper way to keep Shabbat, and some people will say, well, actually, you're allowed to do that, but you can't. But all within a very specific space of what's appropriate and morally good according to the way that it was taught to us by God. And so I'm going to conclude at least the lecture part of this by once again repeating these ideas. I believe in God because I can't understand how anyone who would rationally process this would not believe in God. Just look at the world. Look in the world and you'll see there is an intelligent designer. What exactly that means, I don't believe in a God who stands there with a long white beard and lightning bolts. I don't believe in that either. In fact, I don't believe in anything that has any kind of physical semblance of any form or nature, any physicality, any image, any form, even any limitation other than the ones that God would choose to impose. I believe that there is the Jewish people, and we are a people who have a close connection with God. And we have this close connection through the Torah that we were given. And by studying the Torah and by learning the Torah and learning what it means to us and learning what it means about us, we can fulfill our purpose and our destiny. And so part of the goal of Jewish History Keepers is to try to preserve. I think a lot of people who are Jewish forget what that means. And they think that it's just, you know, this is the family I descend from. And that's good. That's good. Because just simply identifying as a Jew is itself a beautiful thing. But there's more than that. You have a tradition, you have a history, and it's a meaningful one. One that's seeped in so much truth and depth and goodness. And so, for me, I consider it a privilege. I consider myself lucky to have had the opportunity to not only be part of it, but maybe to have the insight, and not everyone who I know who's religious has had this, to say, well, how do I know that what I'm doing is right? And I had to go through my own journey and my own discovery. And I found that not only did I come out with, of course, what I have is right, but I think that in some ways I appreciated more than other people. So I encourage all of you, not telling you what to believe, not telling you how to live your life, but don't live your life simply because this is what works for you and it's convenient. Make sure it's meaningful. Make sure that what you're doing, there's a reason why you're making choices in life. Make sure that what you're doing is based on what you feel is what you were put into this world for. And with that, not only can we see what happens afterwards, but even this life itself takes on so much more meaning. Thank you. Okay, so I'd like to open the questions. It's a free-for-all. Go for it. Take your time. I know that was...
First, you.
Please.
Yeah. I would like to confirm that I understood you correctly. You mentioned, in the beginning of your lecture, you mentioned the God offered all the people of the earth the same
opportunity.
Same love, yes, so something. And how I understood your interpretation that the only Jewish people somehow they already knew they're Jewish. They accepted as God's love when others just rejected this special relationships. Is it correct?
That is correct.
And then I said Jewish people are chosen people. So what comes first? God selected Jews as a chosen people, or Jew people decided for themselves they want a special connection?
What a brilliant question. Before I even answer, I would say that is a great question. No one's ever phrased the question like that, and I think I appreciate it. That's a great way to put it. Are we the chosen people? Did we choose God, or did God choose us?
Kind of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the answer to that, I'll give you first the mystical answer and then the practical answer. The mystical answer is husband and wife, which one chooses which? Right? So that's the mystical answer. That all relationships are two-way streets and it has to go both ways. But in terms of practically speaking, like what actually came first, right? The chicken or the egg. Right? So the answer is that it was Abraham who came first, and he said to God, I'm going to serve you whether you appear to me or not. And you know, when he was, according to our tradition, and when Abraham was saying this, people said, well, then we'll kill you. And he said, fine, kill me if you believe in God. So they said to him, but you don't know if there's a God. Like, why are you giving your life up? And he says, I know there's a God. So he ends up, and you know, they tried to kill him. And of course, God saved him. But this was, when he does this, God says to Abraham, I'm now going to make a covenant with your children forever and ever. But then God still came to us at Sinai and said, are you willing to accept? So that's the order of the events, where Abraham chooses God. God then says to Abraham, we're going to make a covenant with the people. But then God still comes to the people and says, do you accept this Torah? You know, along with it comes a lot of commandments. You know, some of them are really easy to keep. Some of them are exceptionally difficult. You know what we consider to be the hardest mitzvah to keep? Being nice to each other, right? That is so hard. It's so hard, right? Think about all the people who you have a hard time being nice to, right? Some commandments are easy, some commandments are hard. I think people, when they picture hard commandments, they picture like the foods that you can't eat and all of that. Those are easy. I don't even... Especially your kids. Those are easy for... I don't even think about them. But treating people nicely, that's hard. The guy cuts you off in traffic for no reason. Like, honestly, you got the whole lane there. Or that person driving at 40 miles an hour and the... Come on. Right? It's hard to be nice to... I'm kidding. Right. But hopefully that answers your
question. Yes, and I really like the answer. I'm sure you're aware that Christians are not lovers. Christians, they say Jesus Christ is the husband, and the religion is a wife, exactly as you mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean, these ideas are certainly, I'm not here to, you know, I've sat down, I've had, you know, personal debates, not because I think they're necessary, but because very often people who are of the Christian faith feel like there's a need, especially because, you see, Jews believe that Christians can go to heaven, but Christians don't believe Jews can go, so they need to save me. So a number of people have tried to save me, and, you know, we sat down in discussion, and we talked, and you know, very often... At that point, they'll tell them, listen, you want to know why I don't believe? Here's why I don't believe. And, you know, they end up, you know, getting pretty upset. So, you know, I'm not here to, you know, everyone, as we say, it says in Tehillim, Kalish yelchu b'shem elokav, like, everyone should go with their gods, whatever. V'anachnu nelech b'shem Hashem elokim. We're with God, right?
Yes, exactly. But my question is about religions or other people. As you mentioned, all people on the earth are sons and daughters of God, right? Equally. And God is one and only one for all the people. But Jewish people, they have some special connection with the God. So that means all others, they are left in kind of not side by side, and that's what causing them to be anti-Semitic, like they are envious about Jewish people.
That's right.
Is it something like...
Right, right. I'd say resentful is the word. Because envious suggests that I want to be like them, and everyone's welcome. Everyone's welcome. So it's more of a resentment. People don't want to change their lives. They just don't like when other people are doing things better, because then they feel kind of bad. So I would rather everyone kind of lower their standards so that I don't feel so bad about myself. And that's really not a healthy way of living, but that's what turns into hate. Right? If people would not agree with Judaism, it'd be fine. But that hatred, you know, where'd you go from one to the other? Like, honestly, I could be walking down the street and people will say something to me like, I've never hurt you. I've never hurt you, and I wouldn't. Even if you did something to me, I wouldn't hurt you. That's not just, I'm just not that kind of person. So why are you hating on me? Right? It's because you're, like I said, it's because people are missing. They're missing something inside of themselves, and they want to fill that with lashing out or by coping, by hurting someone else, and then I feel powerful or whatever it is, whatever the psychological mechanism of it is. And it's incredible that we're not talking about in specific individual people. We're talking about nations, entire nations, who process this way when you mention the word Jew. So you can see why, for example, in societies that develop where they kind of want to keep everyone in one mindset. Let's take, for example, the development of the Soviet Union. So it was very important for them to eradicate religion for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons is, I know, you know, Marx supposedly said, you know, religion is the opium of the masses, which, by the way, I'm sure you know, is completely misunderstood. He didn't mean it in a negative way. He meant it in a positive way. It means that's how people cope, right? He didn't mean it that it's the drug. He meant that, you know, it helps people be in a better place.
But the
concept of needing to remove religion is really because religion is an obstacle, because religion tells you that you should fight for what's morally appropriate. And if I have a belief that a certain system is important regardless of moral state. So, for example, if you can, you know, take 12 million people and whatever, because it's important for the greater good, you know, that kind of thing, religion doesn't buy into that, so they had to eradicate religion. So, yeah, this is where hate comes from. It's a terrible thing, right?
And then I do apologize for keep asking questions, but this is kind of from this perspective, then we believe that Jew people as a society are the best. And would it be your dream that all suddenly, one day, all people on the earth would become religious Jews? Just everyone.
Religious Jews, not necessarily. But we do. We do it, and it says this in the works of the prophets, that there will come a time when the entire world will recognize God, and we will all of humanity will as one. And what that requires is really very simple. Because if God would reveal himself to the world, just, right, so that would change everything. And so we believe that that's, you know, again, I want to get into futuristic ideas, Mashiach, maybe the rabbi can follow this with a lecture on Mashiach. These are important topics, but I'm sure I'd be happy to explain to everyone. But we're kind of just going to stick to the subjects we discussed. But there is this belief that at some point the whole world will recognize God as God, and it won't be a question. It won't be a doubt to anyone. It will be clear as anything else that there is a God, and everyone will. That does not mean, and we don't need everyone to become a Jew. It's not necessary. We just want everyone to be good people. And part of being a good person, you don't need to believe in God to be good. You could be good without that. But you're doing a lot of guesswork. So if you believe in God, the whole process becomes a lot easier, because then you understand that what's good is the way the greatest knower of good. And a lot of people tell me, well, this thing, oh, I get all these commandments, but this one commandment doesn't make sense to me. It seems immoral. You mean according to your personal understanding? Because your personal understanding is somehow calculated and you figured it all out, and this is the one problem that you have. Right? So, you know, I've also got certain commandments I don't understand. But I say, listen, the other ones do make sense, and since God's smarter than me, I know some may be hard for some people to accept, but you know, but I have no trouble with that. God is smarter than me, so if he tells me that those things are right, like, okay, they probably are.
So that means like Buddhist monks, monasteries, they are exercising some religious rituals and something they are far lower.
I don't know about lower. You didn't even use the word before, better. I don't think I'm better than a non-Jew. I don't think the word better is correct. I'm luckier, right? But let me say it like this. I think Buddhism is a good example, because, you know, Buddha, if he would see the way they practice Buddhism today, he would be outraged. Buddha was an atheist. Right? And Buddhism, in its purest form, is atheism. It was when he introduced this concept, and first people went along with this, but people have a hard time with atheism. And for good reason, because atheism is wrong, right? So what they did was, people started to bring in all the Hindu beliefs and the ancient pagan Chinese beliefs, and all of a sudden Buddha became a statue and you rub its belly. To him, he's like, you missed the whole point, right? The whole point is that there isn't any of this. So I think that's a great example of where people who are practicing this today are actually practicing a mixture of human-created religions and what they believe Buddha said, which I believe is also a human-created, well, he didn't call it a religion. So it's this mixture. So yeah, I don't think they got it right. But if they're living good lives, then who... good for them, right? If they're doing the right thing, what does it matter to me? Okay, so they need to believe better, right? But
yeah, I am afraid of the question. Yeah, I think I understand.
Okay.
I think the question, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the question is, there are other religions that practice peacefully in their specific way to be close to God. Why is that way less chosen, less... why is that way less holy than practicing in the Jewish way to be close to God?
Okay.
Kind of what
yes, exactly. Less
okay.
moral. I use it.
Like why is it correct to use Buddhism or use Hinduism or use whatever to feel the opiate that is
right.
close
okay.
to God?
Good question. Good question. But
yeah.
Sometimes we have to collaborate. I think the answer to that would be that if any human being would just say to himself, I'm going to sit in a corner and I'm going to sit down and figure out what a good person is, I think they'll get 75% of it right. But they won't get all of it right. And it'll be essentially guesswork. So those people are good people.
Because the text, like the Vedas, don't cover and encompass everything
that's there. The Vedas are pagan. They're really pagan
I don't know what Buddhist actually created.
Well, what Buddhism today is the mixture of the ancient Hindu works and some of the ancient Chinese stuff. But the question is, I think it goes back to the same thing would be if someone just on their own, let's forget yoga and whatever, but just on my own, if I sat down and I figured things out based on what I want to do, why isn't that good enough? Mm-hmm. Right? And the answer is because you're only half right. You're certain part, let me phrase it differently, maybe this will answer the question better. Part of being a good person, part of being the greatest good that you can be, is not just morals and behavior, but also understanding and reaching a certain intellectual place. The mind is also part of what we use. So I think, for example, yoga. Let's take yoga for example. Yoga is an incredible way of reaching into the deeper parts of ourselves and connecting body and soul and mind in this way that brings out the best within us. But it doesn't connect you to what's on the outside in any way other than what's happening in your imagination. And so it still makes you a good person, but you're spiritually connecting to what you're picturing are these spiritual forces, but you're not able to define them clearly because you're just human beings. So without God telling you what's out there, without the information, it's just what you're experiencing based on. So it would be no different than the way that the ancients understood the stars. So they believed that the stars and the sun is going around the earth. Why? Because from our perception, that's what it looks like. And so we couldn't really know better until we get outside of ourselves. Yet, they could predict eclipses to the minute. How? Because the systems still function the same way. It's the same mathematical calculations, but the reality that you're picturing is wrong. And so what you need is a telescope that can see outside. What you need is Newton to go, one second, they're spinning like this, there's gravity, that means that it's like this and like that, and you have Copernicus, and all those people who understood the reality of it. So now not only do I have the ability to predict eclipses, I can actually imagine what they actually look like. So I think what you end up with the other religions is that you're able to predict the eclipses, you can find those places, those spiritual connections inside of you, but not really understanding why it's working because you can't see from the outside in. I hope that was it's complicated, but hopefully it was.
It is not complicated, and using your example about Mayas and Aztec culture, they were specifically famous for their very well-developed astronomy, cosmology, science, and they knew exactly what is rotating around, what they could predict, they could build something. And, and first of all, I believe in God, so it's not like it's not like I'm discussing your views.
No, but I want to clarify. Questions are great. I love questions, and we have to ask them no matter what we believe, right?
Yes, and for example, you mentioned Veda, the ancient scripts from India region. But let's talk about Quran, for example. It's not pagan, right? So
no,
why this is? I understand Torah came first, and
let me answer this question in one simple parable. By the way, how much time do we have? Can we go on a bit?
About 15 minutes.
Okay. So let me answer this question like this. If let's say you had an uncle who had multi-billionaire, $100 billion, and your uncle calls you up and says, I'm going to give you $1 billion for you because you're my favorite niece. Okay? Then $1 billion gets deposited in your account, and the next day someone knocks on your door and says, I'm from your uncle. He wants you to give me half of your money to invest. Will you give it to him?
Possible.
Well, what would you ask for first? Verification, right?
Well, yes.
How do I know he's coming from my uncle, right?
That's right.
Okay, so what if this person said to you, well, here's my verification. Your uncle told me that when you were 10 years old, you went on a trip to Disneyland together. So now you're going to give $500 million to this person?
Probably not.
Why not?
More verification.
They could have done their research, right?
Yes.
They could have looked up some random fact about me and my uncle that we have in common. So what would it take? What would for sure do it? A phone call from my uncle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we believe that God came to us and gave us the Torah and said, here's what I think is right. Comes along, Jesus, Muhammad, whoever it is, and says, well, actually, God came to me and said, here's what we should do. So I remember I discussed this once with a Christian. When Jesus came before the Sanhedrin, the high court, and said, I am, prophet. So they said to him, do you know one of the 613 commandments is that when someone comes and claims to be a prophet, we ask him for verification? It's one of the 613 commandments that you must ask for verification. So we asked for verification. You know what his response was? Why do you have no faith? So he left. He comes back the next day, and he says, I'm here, I'm a prophet, I'm here. And they said to him, where's your verification? And again, he says, you have no faith, and he leaves. So I said this to a Christian. I said, that's why we didn't accept him. Where's your verification? I want a phone call from my uncle. God came to us, and he told us, here's the Torah. And then these two individuals come along and say, well, actually, no, it's different. What? So this Christian says to me, well, Where does it say this story? Like, where are you getting your information from? So I said, it's in the New Testament that Jesus came to the Sanhedrin and said, and they said, where's the verification? And he said, you have no faith. It's in the New Testament. So in your own book, it says that you wouldn't provide verification. That's what we believe because, and again, I'm not here to mock any other religion. People believe what they believe. But the thing is, for me, it needs to stand up to this irrational kind of, and just telling me to believe. And I said this to him. He says, well, the more irrational it is, the more faith you can have. I said, well, then I'm the Messiah. He says, that's ridiculous. I said, I know, faith. Right? You know how much faith you would need for me to be the Messiah? Trust me. You'd need a lot of faith. Right? So, we don't believe that way. We believe that God doesn't trick people. God doesn't make it impossible to figure it out. God doesn't tell one person and then everyone has to believe this one person. We just don't think, because again, back to my original point, is that God could have just made us and left us to fend for ourselves. But we'd be a mess. We were a mess. We were practicing human sacrifice. When I say human sacrifice, I mean people were offering their own children, right? So that's the whole test of Abraham was, you know, could you at least pretend, could you go along with it, even though it's the opposite of everything? I mean, again, let's not talk about that now. But the people weren't getting it right. And the answer, we believe that God doesn't leave it to people to guess. He allows us to figure it out and gives us at least fair opportunity. Having one person bring up, so that's really the again, do I know the truth? Do I not know the truth? I don't know. But what I do know is that one person coming with a book is not something that's going to make me give up what I believe God gave to my entire people. So for Muslims, I believe that a good Muslim who follows what it says in his religion and keeps the seven Noahide laws is going to have a place in heaven. Even though he doesn't believe that I will, I'm fine. Right? I'll be happy to have that discussion with him in heaven if hopefully I make it there. But I'm not going to change because one person comes along. So that's really basically, that's what it comes down to, why the Jewish people did not go along with the other religions that were brought up and suggested. Again, from a rational point of view. Yes?
You said that unlike some others who were just born into it and followed blindly, believed what their parents told them, what their rabbis and other leaders told them, you question some things more than others around you. What was something that you questioned the most, and what answer did you come to?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure if, how much we're supposed to share about, you know, these deep internal things, but I'm going to anyway because I'm comfortable with it. But
okay.
But I'm just not sure if me doing that is the right thing. But I'm going to do it anyway. But, okay.
You don't have to.
No, I'm going to do it anyway. One of the I think it's the question that when I was a teenager, probably bothered me more than anyone else is, how do I know that whatever I believe isn't just because that's the way I was raised? And I think that that's a question that everyone on the outside wants everyone on the inside to ask, but not everyone on the outside asks that question either, right? Because so many people are like, well, what, maybe you're just religious because you were raised that way. Well, maybe you're not religious because you weren't raised that way, right? So, and it's probably true. But that was a question that I did feel the need to ask myself. And I spent a lot of time. Now, that didn't mean that at any point I would stop practicing as a result of this question, because I'm hedging my bets here, right? I don't want to lose that time. But I did, in studying, and maybe it's just me, but it's so perfectly organized that I was like, yeah, that works. And that's why I am where I am today, because it works, it makes sense to me. And I would say that, you know, especially there's a great work by Rabbi Yosef Albo called Sefer Ikarim, written in Spain in the 1400s. It's just an incredible work of philosophy. So he's another one of those Jewish philosophers. Rabbi Yosef Albo, Sefer HaIkarim. Ikarim, yeah. This book, basically he starts the book like this. He says, I'm taking nothing for granted. So even though I'm going to spend four chapters is talking about whether a human being can know anything or not, right? Are there any givens? He spends four chapters. Well, wait, is it true that at least that 2 + 2 = 4? I mean, he uses a different example, that a triangle, you know, that these angles are all going to equal 180. Is it true that every triangle, but maybe it's not? How do we know it's really true? So he starts with, first let's establish whether or not we're capable of knowing things. That's how far he goes. And then step after step, and he goes through and he says, okay, so now he spent one third of the book discussing why he believes there's a God. And then once he says, a third of the book, right? So once he says, okay, now that I know there's a God, now how do I know that God has a reason for something. Then he spends four chapters discussing whether creation without a purpose, would that be within God, without God? And so he, step by step by step, and if there is a reason, then he must communicate it, and if it's communication, there must be prophecy, another 20 chapters, and if there's prophecy, how do we know who's a prophet, another 30 chapters. It's just this really long book, and I once tried giving a class on it, and people were like, can we please learn something else? It's just, but in this work, you know, he kind of goes through this, and that works for me. You know, things are organized and explained like that. It just, yeah.
That answers my question.
Okay. Yes?
So you gave a very interesting theory around anti-Semitism. So what was actually the Jewish people's reaction to this? Why haven't they actually done much about it for 2,000 years? That's the first question. And then the second question, you know, you're talking about free will and so on. I mean, why haven't they done the obvious thing over 2,000 years and just go back to their homeland when, you know, they probably could have done it like multiple times?
Yeah, interesting question. Interesting question. I would say, simply put, it's the simplest answer to that is because exile meant just that we were exiled for our sins. And we understood it that way. So from a religious perspective, it was the position of the religious Jew that we are to remain in exile. And part of being in exile is to try to remain distinct and kind of keep our own communities so that we can survive for when we will come back. Right? And it actually, amazingly, and this is something that people don't realize, it says in the Torah, in the Chumash, right, in the Bible, it says, you will be cast out from your land, and after some time, I will bring you back. It says that. And you will return. And it's happened, right? So, like I said before, it's a miracle that any nation should survive on its own for 100 years, you know, 200 years, 300 years, just beyond, and here we are 2,000 years later. But the reason why we didn't go back before is because we believed that we weren't allowed to, because that's what exile meant until we were brought back by Mashiach. Again, a whole another subject. And part of that was this belief that we aren't really entitled to defend ourselves as a nation, even if we're entitled to defend ourselves individually. And so we were kind of left, because without a nation, when you're guests, I mean, what really could you do? What could you do? So until, you know, for example, the United States of America today, God forbid I'm going to talk like that, because the United States is the kindest country that's ever been for the Jewish people in exile. But could you imagine if all of a sudden the country took up arms against the Jews? I mean, what would we do, right? So today we have a state of Israel, right? So if Jews anywhere in diaspora find themselves, let's say, in the middle of a war, so if, you know, the state of Israel is there, they'll send in some planes and scoop you out, right? That's happening right now across the street, right? So across the pond. Right? So that's a new idea, but to answer your question, it's simply because we believed that part of being in exile is to not create this nationhood and fight back. I don't know if it was the right decision on it, but that's the way we approached exile, and that's the reason why we did it. There are a few rare examples, but they're rare and few between, of Jews standing up and defending themselves. You know, for example, the Jews in Italy in the 1500s who went to war against the Pope, again, long stories, but these are individual incidences of Jews kind of standing up for themselves. But generally speaking, we felt like we were meek and tiny, and we ran, and you know, that's part of being in exile. Yes.
I think also Jews took sides, and after exile from Spain, a lot of them ended up in Turkey, and then they actually ended up, and a lot of them, in a fleet of the Turkish Empire. And they sunk a lot of...
Yeah, listen, many of the pirates of the Caribbean were Jewish, and they attacked specifically Spanish ships, and it's because, you know, we were kicked out of the land, they made us leave without any of our money and property, and, you know, going back to England in 1293, King James, he was short on money, so what does he do? You kick the Jews out, and you take all their money, and that's your one-time major influx of wealth, which is better than, at that point you have a choice. Do you, slowly tax the Jews, and every 100 years get a little bit of money, or you do one big expulsion and take all their money? So he made that choice then. But it's strange how that went, but again, I don't think we really had much choice other than to en masse return, and we consider that to be not allowed. Now, why that changed in the 19th and 20th century, that has to do with religious Zionism and secular Zionism, and that's a whole another lecture. Right. Okay. All right, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. So once again, I want to thank the shul. Thank you for hosting us. And if you have any...
Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit? You know, you started the lecture.